Okay, so last week we talked about what apologetics is, and we just defined apologetics as the defense of the Christian faith, the rational defense of the Christian faith. You know, the word apologize has now been watered down. It now means to make an excuse for something. But originally it meant to make a defense of the faith. And the word apologia, where we get apologetics from, is found in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. We talked a little bit about the anti-apologetics view called fideism, that you just have to believe by faith. And we said it's kind of unfortunate that Soren Kierkegaard's unique definition of faith is kind of rampant throughout the church today, so that we have a lot of people who believe that we're not supposed to present evidence for faith. This is one of the reasons why so many so many kids who come from evangelical homes are losing their faith. I think it's somewhere between 75 and 88%, according to Barner research, that lose their faith during their first year of college. Now, I like to see these same kids interviewed 10 years later. And when their brilliant atheist professors aren't there to grade their papers, I think we're going to find a lot of them will get married, they'll have kids, and they'll get back to church. But whatever the case, we really have not been doing a good job preparing our young people for the kind of intellectual assaults on the Christian faith that they receive in college. And a lot of it goes back to the Kierkegaardian view of faith, that faith is not based on reason. It's an illogical thing. How many people drove over a bridge to get here tonight? Like either the Warren Avenue Bridge or something? Yeah, that you're exercising a tremendous amount of faith in man's ability to build bridges, but that's a well-reasoned faith. I try never to be the first guy over a newly built bridge. I give it a couple days, and if I don't read any horror stories in the newspaper, then I go. But that's a pretty well-founded, solid faith. But that's the way Christianity is. There is good evidence, solid evidence for Christianity, and the Bible actually says there's no apologetic for those who reject God. We translate it as no, they are without excuse. Literally, it's they have no apologetic. Those who reject the existence of God, who has revealed his existence to us through nature. We talked about the fact that the Bible commands us to do apologetics, and the Bible speaks of God revealing himself, giving evidence of his existence to us in nature, both in creation and our conscience, and that the Bible also speaks of historical evidences. You know, Christianity is based on eyewitness testimony of those who saw Jesus risen from the dead. Okay, and then the early church defended the faith, and we showed that Peter, John, Luke, Jude, Apollos, and Paul all defended the faith. And then we talked about why apologetics is needed. So you can review that by looking at the first two pages of your notes. And so where we left off is the failure of atheistic arguments. Now, if you look at the Defending the Faith course, the schedule, we're already behind, so I'm going to try to do my best to get through as much of the material as possible. We may have to either spend less time on Old Testament reliability or just not cover that in order to cover everything else. So we'll see how it goes. But what do I want to deal with right now are non-theistic worldviews. See, Christianity is a theistic religion. Christians believe in the existence of a personal God who is separate from the universe. He's not identical to the universe. At the same time, he's involved with the universe. He sustains it in existence, and he can intervene and perform miracles whenever he chooses to do so. And so Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are all theistic religions. In fact, to be more specific, we're monotheistic religions. We believe in the existence of one personal God who is involved with the universe, that's immanence, but is also distinct from and separate from and beyond the universe, and that's transcendence. And so what we first want to do is what some would call theistic apologetics. We want to defend the existence of a personal God. And so we're going to talk about different worldviews, and we're going to defend theism. Now, if we ended the course just by defending theism, you know, we wouldn't know, well, is it Christian theism, the current state of Jewish theism, or is it Islamic theism? And so that's where we get into historical apologetics and argue that the true Jesus of history is the Jesus we find in the New Testament, not the Jesus proclaimed by Judaism or Islam. They have a different Jesus. They reject the true Jesus of the Bible, who is God incarnate and the Savior of mankind. Okay, so first thing we're going to do is look at atheism, the worldview that there is no God. Let me say this. Pat, I'm going to walk over there. This isn't for any illustration or anything. It's just a middle-aged guy getting his reading glasses. Just didn't want to freak you out there. But whatever the case, atheism is the belief that there is no God. Now, technically, atheism died in the 1920s. Okay? In the 1920s, scientists discovered that the universe was expanding as we move forward in time. Edwin Hubble, the guy they named the Hubble telescope after, and that led to Big Bang cosmology, the idea that the universe began with this explosion a finite time ago. And the atheists of the 19th century, the 1800s, like Friedrich Nietzsche, who died in the year 1900, the German atheist, they used to argue that the universe doesn't need a cause because it didn't have a beginning. The universe was always here. Virtually no thinking atheist holds to that view anymore. Okay? So now everybody agrees the universe had a beginning. So right now the debate between Christians and atheists is either in the beginning God created the universe, or in the beginning nothing created the universe. And that's why two friends of mine, Norman Geisler and Frank Turek, wrote a book, I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. Okay, it's some kind of miracle occurred, something that supersedes natural laws, some kind of miracle occurred for the universe to come into existence from nothing. So if you want to believe in miracles without a miracle working God, become an atheist. If you think, well, if there's miracles, there must be a miracle working God, then be a Christian. But I would argue that Paul is right, that the atheist is really without an apologetic. So technically speaking, because of Big Bang cosmology, atheism was thoroughly refuted. Rather than admitting defeat, what they did was they changed the definition of atheism. So atheism used to be the belief that there is no God. And they didn't make a case that there is no God. Now, what we call atheism today, today's leading atheists, are actually what we would call hard agnostics. Agnosticism is from the Greek words that mean no knowledge. So a soft agnostic says, well, I don't believe in God because I haven't seen enough evidence. But maybe there is evidence for God, but I just haven't seen it. A hard agnostic said, look, there isn't enough evidence to believe in God. God probably doesn't exist. This is why Richard Dawkins in the Expelled movie said, well, God doesn't exist. He said, Ben Stein said, are you 100% sure? No. He said, well, how sure are you? Is it 40%, 50%, 60%? But it's because Dawkins, the world's leading atheist, is really a hard agnostic. But rather than admit, well, we were defeated because of Big Bang cosmology, so now we're just arguing that God probably doesn't exist, and we lack belief in God. And there's another reason why they do that as well. To redefine atheism, rather than the positive belief there is no God, just as the lack of belief in God, they always say, well, I have nothing to defend. I just lack belief. You're the one who has a belief. The burden of proof is on you. Okay? My response when I take the bait is, look, you got a worldview. And you're passionate about defending that worldview, or you wouldn't be debating me on a college campus tonight. So it's my worldview, theism, versus your worldview, atheism. And let's go head to head, and let's just see which worldview has more explanatory power. And then I argue that theism, belief in God, is more reasonable than atheism. And I usually turn to somewhere between 9 and 13 different aspects of human experience. We'll go over that in my cumulative case for God. But I just want you to know that technically speaking, today's thinkers and philosophers and scientists who call themselves atheists, really, they're hard agnostics. They just changed the definition of atheism rather than admitting that atheism was defeated earlier in the 20th century. So atheism is the belief that God definitely does not exist. You really won't find hardly any thinking atheists today. But agnosticism, the belief, is either the belief that man doesn't know if God exists, that's soft agnosticism, but hard agnosticism is the belief that man cannot know if God exists. And so we're going to deal with really hard agnosticism / atheism, okay? Because those are the ones that are attacking Christianity. A soft agnostic might even be open. Might say, hey, you know, I think what you Christians are doing, you do a lot of good stuff and everything. I might visit your church someday. And yeah, I'd be willing to talk with you about God's existence. I think if I was a soft agnostic, when I debated Eddie Tabash, a Beverly Hills lawyer who worked for the Clinton administration, I debated him at Washington State University, and they had a philosophy professor from Washington State University who was the moderator of the debate. When the debate was over, he told me that. I said, man, you did really good, you know, and I said, yeah, well, Eddie did good too. And he said, no, you did really good. So he's saying that Eddie didn't do too good. But it turned out he's an agnostic. But his wife is Roman Catholic, and out of respect for her, he not only takes her to Mass every Sunday, but he attends Mass with her. And he thought that the theist, myself, did a better job than the atheist. That sounds more like a soft agnostic. Somebody who doesn't think God exists, but is open to discussion and to look at the evidence. But we're going to deal with the hard agnostics. And all. Hey, here's another problem with atheism. It's self-refuting. In order to know that God exists, to know with certainty, you'd have to be all-knowing to disprove God's existence. You'd have to be able to see the entire universe in one glance, because you might be somewhere and God might be somewhere else. And then if God is non-material, which is what Christianity teaches, you'd have to be able to see the entire physical reality simultaneously with the entire spiritual reality. So in other words, you'd have to have the attributes of God to definitely disprove God. And so that's why atheism has kind of toned down their rhetoric, but I think that they've actually become hard agnostics. But even hard agnosticism, we say that man cannot know God. We can't know about God. We can't even know if God exists. Well, the fact is, you got to know something about God to know that nothing can be known about Him. Okay? So these are self-refuting. Now, you know, somebody could say, well, if there's an infinite God, the finite can never reach the infinite on its own. Yeah, amen. But that's why God wrote the Bible. That's why God the Son became a man, to provide salvation for us. Because even though the finite, the limited man, cannot reach the infinite God on his own and through his own strength, the infinite God has chosen to reveal himself to us in his word, and has chosen to reveal himself to us through his Son and provide salvation for us. So it's not a case of the finite reaching up to the infinite, it's the infinite. You know, we're bound, we have limitations. We can't reach out to him, but he can reach down to us. And that's exactly what he did, according to the scriptures. So I'm just going to just call it atheism, because that's what they call themselves, but they're really hard agnostics. So I'm just going to call them atheistic arguments, and we're just going to deal with some of these. We're not going to have time for all of them. The first one we want to deal with is the idea of God as a product of man's imagination. So, in other words, these guys are saying that God did not create man in his image. Instead, man created God in his image. So we create God through wishful thinking or something along those lines. Ludwig Feuerbach, a German philosopher, he argued that due to the fear of death, man created God by his own imagination. God is what man wishes to be. Feuerbach went so far to say that theology is anthropology. In other words, when we think we're studying God, we're really just studying about man, because man projects himself in a cosmic way and then calls that invention God. Sigmund Freud argued that due to man's guilt for hating his father, he's got some weird ideas about the first human beings. They banded together. They wanted to have sexual relations with their mothers. First band of humans was one man and numerous wives. The sons wanted to have sexual relations with their mothers, so they banded together and killed the father, and then they felt guilty about it, so they ate him in a ritual meal. And then they were afraid of nature, so they wished that they could personify nature, make nature a person. And then they could beg nature for mercy, so they brought the two concepts together, says Sigmund Freud, and that's how religion got started, where they turned nature into the father God, and then they offered sacrifices and begged God not to kill them with a tornado and things of that sort. And so, you know, all this wild speculation, and we're supposed to be the ones who have blind faith. But whatever the case, the Bible would agree with Freud and Feuerbach that this does explain false idols. But no one would wish for the God of the Bible. R.C. Sproul makes a really good point on that. That if you're going to invent a God by your own imagination, it's going to be something like the wimp God of the New Age movement, where you can look in the mirror and say, wow, I'm looking at my God. And I get to do whatever I want to do. But the God of the Bible is a God who says, thou shalt not, when we want to do something. And says, thou shalt do something when we don't want to do it. And then this God of the Bible is a just God who will judge the living and the dead someday. That's not the kind of God man's going to invent by wishful thinking. Gee, I wish that a God existed who would throw me in hell forever if I don't get with his program. It doesn't sound like something that we would wish for. So, you know, in reality, these are not Freud and Feuerbach. These are not. It's not actually an argument against God's existence. Rather, it's an attempt by atheists to explain why so many people disagree with them. Okay, so it's not. Freud didn't say, wow, I found evidence that God doesn't exist, I'm going to stop believing in him. Freud already didn't believe in God. Feuerbach already didn't believe in God. And then they looked around and they said, how come only intellectuals like us, you know, they only give you the title intellectual if you're an atheist, how come only the intellectuals, you know, like 5% of the world's population are atheists? If we're right, how come 95% of the world disagrees with us? And Sigmund Freud's conclusions, his conclusion of the matter was that the rest of us are neurotic or psychotic. All I can say is if you think 95% of the people on the planet Earth are crazy, you should be open to an alternative explanation, which would say something about you and your 5%. Friedrich Nietzsche, it's really interesting. He said God is dead and traditional values have died with him. But when Nietzsche said God is dead, what he meant was that Christianity is the driving force of Western civilization. Christianity was no longer the driving force of Western civilization. And so it supplied us with Western man with meaning in life, a set of moral laws, a set of truths. And Nietzsche said, look, if we don't believe in God, we've thrown God off the bridge. But Nietzsche said to his atheist buddies, we were right to throw God off the bridge, but we were wrong to go through his pockets before we did. and say, oh, look, absolute truth, we need this, we can't live without that. Oh, absolute morality, we need that. Oh, meaning in life, got to have this. Oh, some type of sanctity of human life so we don't kill each other off. Yeah, we need this. Okay, now let's throw God off the bridge. Nietzsche was the first of modern times, was the first atheist who was at least attempting to be consistent with his atheism. And he said, if God is dead, truth is dead, morality is dead, meaning is dead, the only thing where he failed to realize that man is dead too. And I argue for that in The Death of Western Civilization, a paper I wrote. It's in a book I wrote, God, Government, and the Road to Tyranny, a Christian view of government and morality, that if God is dead, man is dead too. C.S. Lewis pointed that out in The Abolition of Man. Francis Schaeffer pointed that out in Beyond, or Back to Freedom and Human Dignity. But whatever the case, Nietzsche at least acknowledged, well, if God is dead, truth is dead, morality is dead, and meaning in life is dead as well. Therefore, he called for a group of supermen to arrive on the scene and create their own truth, even though it doesn't really exist, create their own morality, create their own meaning, and then force that down everybody else's throats. What I like about Nietzsche is the fact that he gives us some really good arguments for God's existence. Because he says, if God doesn't exist, there is no absolute truth. There is no absolute morality. You know, an atheist always says, no such thing as right and wrong. But you Christians are wrong to try to teach your views in the public school. No, wait, hold on. If there's no such thing as right and wrong, Christians are never wrong. Leave us alone. So that they say there's no such thing as right and wrong, but they still live with moral categories and make moral value judgments. And so basically, from Nietzsche, we can argue, if life is meaningful, then God must exist. If there is absolute truth, God must exist. If there is absolute morality, then the absolute moral lawgiver must exist. And so Nietzsche, being a consistent, at least trying to be a consistent atheist, actually gives us some ammunition there. By the way, the Nazis tried to be the Superman. And Nietzsche didn't like the Nazis, even though he died in 1900. The Nazi Party was already in existence at that point. But it's like, you know, he didn't like the racism of the Nazis. Well, Nietzsche was a sickly wimp, to be honest with you. He wasn't the Superman. Everything the Superman was, Nietzsche was not. So what right does he, if there's no such thing as right and wrong, what right does he have to say that these guys who think they're the Supermen, that no, you guys are doing it wrong? What, are you going to go to Mount Sinai and bring down a couple commandments to hold them in judgment? So it's kind of like, if you don't like them, I mean, they got the power of the gun. But Nietzsche did predict that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in the history of mankind. And it was, because it would be atheistic man come of age. We would begin to figure out what Nietzsche said. He was the madman who came too early, came shining a light in the morning hours long before darkness came. He said, I come too early. And so he knew that eventually atheistic man would realize what he realized. You know, see, the atheists were saying, God is dead, now it's business as usual. Nietzsche was saying, God is dead, and it terrifies me, because everything changes. If God is dead, then the earth has been detached from its sun. There's no longer any up or down, no right or wrong, and everything is up for grabs. And so Nietzsche, he died insane. Many think it's because he may have had syphilis. But trying to be a consistent atheist made him a very pessimistic guy. And the triumphant atheists like Richard Dawkins and the late Christopher Hitchens, it's really not consistent with atheism. If we're alone in this universe, in the end, evil wins. And when the whole universe blows up, man blows up with it. A.J. Ayres and logical positivism. This was a view that the verification principle, that talk about God is without meaning because truth can only be found through the five senses, or it's something that's true by definition, but But basically, if we can narrow down the verification principle, it's basically saying, look, for something to be meaningful, it has to be either true by definition, which the verification principle is not, or you got to be able to prove it through the five senses, which you can't do with the verification principle. So in other words, all I want to say tonight about the verification principle is that it fails its own test for truth. It can't be true. It's self-refuting. So if somebody comes up and tells you, I only believe what my senses tell me. Truth can only be found through the five senses. And then you just ask them, well, do you believe that that statement is true? And then they'll say yes. And then say, well, can you prove it through the five senses? Because if you can't, by your own definition, you shouldn't believe that. So one of the greatest anti-intellectual statements of all time is the statement that truth can only be found through the five senses. It's an embarrassing statement in the history of philosophy. Yet people like Richard Dawkins, who are not trained philosophers, he's a scientist, he continues to make statements like that. I'm sure he embarrasses a lot of atheist philosophers as well as Christian philosophers. Let's skip down to... Okay, Bertrand Russell said, if everything needs a cause, then so does God. Okay? Because if everything needs a cause, God is something that exists. Wouldn't that be right? If everything needs a cause, then so does God. And we haven't solved anything. Read Christian thinkers, leading Christian thinkers throughout the past 2,000 years, and you will find no one using this argument. Nobody argues that everything needs a cause, therefore God must exist. They argue basically that everything that had a beginning needs a cause, or everything that is limited needs a cause, or everything that is temporary needs a cause, and eventually you got to arrive at an eternal, infinite being to ground the existence of all the temporary existence. But no knowledgeable Christian argues that everything needs a cause, because we believe that God is the uncaused cause that explains everything else that exists. I mean, if everything needs a cause, then there would really be no explanation for anything. It'd be just one big merry-go-round. There's got to be a first cause, and the first cause has to be an uncaused cause. Okay, we're not going to deal with the problem of evil. We're going to save that for its own lecture. Albert Camus was a French existentialist. You don't have to know what an existentialist is, but it just man creates his own, there is no God, so man creates his own meaning through an act of the will. And he wrote a book, The Plague, which is real interesting, and the priest in the book represents Christianity, and he argues since God allowed the plague, then to fight the plague is to fight God. Because God allowed, even if you say, well, wait, but maybe God allowed the plague for purposes of a greater good. Maybe God allowed the Holocaust for purposes of a greater good. Well, then Camus would say, yeah, okay, well, then if you try to fight the Holocaust or you try to fight the plague and you believe in God, you're fighting God's greater good. So he says that religious people, those who believe in God, should be anti-humanitarian. Okay? Now, first thing I would say about that, that's not what history shows us. Whether it's consistent or not, history shows us that people who believe in God, especially Christians and Jews, we're the ones who built the first hospitals. We're the ones who built the first orphanages and the first schools. Okay? So, apparently we don't agree with him on this point. The second thing, though, is that part of the greater good that God may want to bring out of the plague is that as God fights the plague, he may be trying to motivate us to join him in his fight against the plague. And so God allows evil for purposes of a greater good, but one of the greater goods is that man can join God in this battle against evil. Now, I would reverse it on Albert Camus and say, if there is no God, and there's no such thing as right and wrong, and life is without meaning, which all things that Camus believed, then why in the world fight the plague? I don't see any atheist. You know, it amazes me that atheists will borrow, like Cornelius Van Til has stated, a Christian philosopher, a Christian theologian actually, that atheists love to borrow capital from the Christian worldview. And so atheists will condemn things as wrong. But the fact of the matter is their worldview doesn't have any basis to call things like murder wrong. Okay? So what they do, so it's kind of like they say, well, God is dead, but anytime I need it, I'm going to resurrect. Now, God is dead and there's no such thing as right and wrong, but anytime I need to judge somebody, I'm going to resurrect some Christian moral values. That's cheating. Okay? If you don't want the Christian God and you don't want the Christian worldview, then you can't steal from it whenever it's comfortable for you to do so. Let's take a look at a couple arguments from contradictory attributes. An all-powerful God can do anything. You know, most Christians would say, yes, yeah, that's true, an all-powerful God can do anything. Even create a rock that he cannot lift. But if he can't lift this rock, then he's not all-powerful. Therefore, no all-powerful God exists. What shocks me is that atheist philosophers, usually at community colleges, still bring this argument up when it's been thoroughly refuted. See, no leading Christian thinker throughout the centuries ever defined God's omnipotence, the fact that he is all powerful, as God having the ability to do anything. Okay? Now, this may come as a shock to a lot of believers, but the Bible teaches that there are lots and lots of things God cannot do. The Bible says God cannot sin. He cannot be tempted to sin. He cannot lie. He cannot change his mind. If he's all powerful, by definition, he can't fail. Okay? But see, all the things that God cannot do just emphasize the fact that he's all powerful. So if God's all powerful, he can accomplish anything he sets out to do. If God's all powerful, he can never fail. The illustration that the atheist brings up, God creating a rock that he can't lift, that would involve failure. So however big that rock is that the atheist is thinking about, God can create a much bigger rock than that. But as the creator of that rock, he will always be able to master that rock and lift that rock. See, God cannot do the impossible. When the Bible talks about God being able to do the impossible, what it means is God can do that which is humanly impossible. But there are some things that are just logically impossible. God cannot create square circles. Because by definition, it's impossible for a square circle to exist. God can do anything that is possible, but he can't do the impossible. He cannot. He's a logical God, so he cannot violate his logic, his reason. He can't create square circles. He can't create a God that is greater than him. Because there's no possibility of any being greater than him. He also cannot do things that will contradict his moral nature. Okay? So, God cannot sin. He can't lie. And things of that sort. So God is all powerful, but there are things that even he cannot do, such as fail, or sin, or lie, or change his mind. God can't do what is impossible by nature. He can't create square circles. He'll always be able to master his creation. So this argument sounds real strong, but it's based upon a false definition of God's omnipotence. The second argument, either something is good because God wills it. If something's good just because God willed it, then it would be arbitrary. The good would be arbitrary. It would be like God said, you know what, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. I'm going to arbitrarily choose feeding hungry people. I'm going to make that good. And I'm arbitrarily going to choose to make killing innocent people evil. But if God's will is arbitrary, then God could have chosen otherwise. He could have said killing innocent people is good and feeding hungry people is evil. So we don't want the good to be arbitrary. So the dilemma is either something is good because God wills it, merely because God wills it, where God's will is the ultimate thing. You know, by the way, there are some Christians who hold this view. That there are some Christians who believe that God created sin. And that God made Adam fall and he made Lucifer fall. I don't hold to that position. Gordon Clark was a Christian who held to it. That's called voluntarism, where they believe God's will is the ultimate and God arbitrarily chooses what's right and what's wrong. But if it's not that way, then the alternative is where God wills it because it is good. But then it seems that the good is a standard that's above God, and then God wouldn't be God if there's something above him, if there's a standard that he has to obey. So therefore, either good is arbitrary, we Christians can't accept that, or good is above God, and we can't accept that. So we seem to be stuck here. Well, the response is that God wills it because it is consistent with his own good nature. God is by nature good. That which is good is not arbitrary, it's what flows naturally from God's good nature. So the standard is not above God. God is the standard. God is good. Nor is the standard arbitrary. Okay? So God's will is only subservient to God's good nature. Because God is by nature good, he can only will that which is good. Okay? Now Anthony Flew, this is really interesting. I spelled his name wrong. It's not Anthony, it's Anthony. There's no H. But Anthony Flew was a British philosopher, was the world's leading atheist. And he said there's the problem with God is it's a meaningless statement because there's no way to falsify the invisible gardener. If an atheist and a Christian walked into the wilderness and they saw a beautiful garden, the Christian would say, well, there must be a gardener. And the atheist could say, no, it just got here by chance. It just grew. And they said, well, let's camp out and see if the gardener comes and upkeeps his garden. And they camp out and they don't see the gardener. And so then the believer says, well, maybe the gardener's invisible. And so they set up fences and they get hound dogs and they electrify the fences and stuff, and still no sign of the invisible gardener. And so the Christian says, well, maybe he's not only invisible, but he's not perceivable by any of the senses. And so Anthony Flew says, what's the difference between your God and an invisible gardener? But what he fails to admit is that the Christian doesn't believe in an absentee God like the deist does, a God that doesn't perform miracles. We believe in a God who's revealed himself through fulfilled prophecies, miracles that have been witnessed by people, and Jesus' bodily resurrection from the dead. I think it's rather interesting that Anthony Flew, before he died, lost numerous debates to my old professor from Liberty University, Gary Habermas, on the issue of whether or not Jesus rose from the dead. And Flew would have been the first to admit that he lost every debate he ever had with Gary Habermas. And if you saw the debates, you would admit it too. So here he's saying there's no way to falsify the invisible gardener. Well, just try disproving the resurrection, Anthony. You didn't have much success at that. By the way, Anthony Flew eventually acknowledged the evidence of design pointing to the existence of God. And so he embraced theism and accepted God's existence before he died. But as far as we know, he never became a Christian. Although in his book, Why I Am an Atheist, he asked N.T. Wright, probably the world's leading New Testament scholar out of Great Britain, to give a chapter on evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And Anthony Flew said if he ever accepted a revelatory religion, in other words, a religion where God can reveal himself, it would be Christianity because of the charisma of Jesus and the intellect of the Apostle Paul. So let's hope and pray that Anthony Flew's in heaven, that maybe he made a deathbed conversion to Christ because he had come so far in his thought. But basically what I'm saying is, all you have to do to falsify the invisible gardener argument right now is to say, well, the guy who came up with the argument didn't hold to it when he died. He acknowledged that there was enough evidence for the existence of this invisible gardener. We'll talk about the absurdity of life without God later on. I'll just close this segment. We'll take a little bit of a break, a 5-minute break. But I'll just close it that the real problem with atheists is not really the intellect, not the mind. Much of the intellectual argumentation, you know, the Bible says that atheists, people who reject the true God, they suppress the truth that God has revealed them. You can't suppress truth unless deep down inside you know it. Now, I think these guys would pass lie detector tests because the easiest person to lie to is yourself. Every time you sin, it comes with a built-in excuse, and then you're the only person on the planet Earth gullible enough to believe it. And then you've got this challenge of trying to convince others to believe that lame excuse to justify your actions. But it's not really an intellectual problem. The problem is really moral. It's a problem not of the mind, but of the will. And this is what the Bible teaches, that it's not that Richard Dawkins hasn't seen enough evidence to believe in God. It's that Richard Dawkins hates God. My question to the new atheist like Richard Dawkins, he says that, you know, teaching children about God is child abuse, and obviously he wants child abusers to be punished. So what does he want to do with Sunday school teachers and Christian school teachers? But you look at this guy, he gets red in the face. He gets real passionate. So my question to the Richard Dawkins of the world is, if you don't believe that God exists, why do you hate him with so much passion? And this guy's a devoted to what? And he says, believing in God is like believing in the existence of the flying spaghetti monster. And it's like, you haven't made a dime debating on college campuses against the existence of the flying spaghetti monster. You've made millions writing books and arguing against the God of the Bible. Seems to me like there's a big difference between the God of the Bible and the flying spaghetti monster, and you know it, Richard Dawkins, or you wouldn't be writing these books and taking these debates. And so basically what I think is going on there, and you can read John 3:19-21, Romans 1:18-22, which also, you know, show us that the real problem with the atheist is not the intellect, it's really the will. It's a moral problem. It's not that we don't believe that God exists. We don't want God to exist. Okay? So it's not we invent the father image by wishful thinking. We're trying to kill the father image because we don't want to have to answer to anybody. See, man's two greatest drives are the drive for transcendence, man's thirst for God, which I believe God put in our hearts, but also man's desire to be his own God. The desire for human autonomy. And so that's why C.S. Lewis said the big battle that we face is either we have to decide not my will be done, but thy will be done, your will be done, or not your will be done, but my will be done. And so the whole Jesus issue that we face, it's all about whether we're going to decide to give in to our thirst for God and trust in Jesus, who is the bread of life. He who comes to him shall never hunger. He who believes in him shall never thirst. He's the living water. Or we can choose to side with our drive for human autonomy, and despite all the evidence for God, we can just continue to deny that he exists. And so let's take a 5-minute break. And if you got in here late and you didn't get any of the books, there's a few books back there. We're giving away free books. Take one of each. And then make sure you grab the notes from back there as well. Did we pass a paper around to be signed?
It's back on the
table. Okay. If you already signed your email address last week, you can just jot down your name. I think they want me to tell them who was in attendance and stuff like that. But if you didn't, if you weren't here last week, write down both your name and your email address. Everybody, if you'd take a seat, we're... We're not going to spend as much time on the other worldviews as we did on atheism. So I'm just going to run through these. If you start turning the pages forward, go past the arguments for God's existence and the teleological argument, refuting moral relativism, go past the cumulative case for God, go past the case for creation, and then you'll get to seven basic worldview questions. Turn the page there until you see worldviews at the top. And atheism is the first one listed. So I don't know if you can find that. It's probably about halfway through. And there's just a section that just says worldviews. And we're just going to take a look at some of the non-theistic worldviews. After tonight, starting next week, we'll start arguing for, providing evidence for the existence of the personal God. But we mentioned that atheism, the belief that there is no God, the problem with that, there's no adequate explanation for the existence of the universe, for the intelligent design found in the universe, for the morality that we experience in the universe. To be totally honest with you, when a Christian reasons, uses thinking ability and argues for God, that makes sense. Because when I use my reason, I believe that a rational God created me in His image so that I'm a rational being. But the atheist believes that we accidentally got here by non-rational causes. So I don't know why the atheist would have any confidence in what his reason tells him. So atheism has no reason to trust in the validity of human reason. And C.S. Lewis did a really good job in his work, Miracles, on that. That he argued that the only way we would have reason to trust what reason with a small r tells us is if we posit the existence of reason with a capital R. So if our reason doesn't have a rational cause, then our reason might look like it's reasonable, but we have no way of knowing that. But the atheist does trust his reason. If there's no God, I think Nietzsche is right. There's no God, there's no such thing as truth. Yet the atheist believes that atheism is true. So, it's Dan Barker pointed that out in the debate with him. He believes atheism is true, but he believes there's no such thing as truth. If there's no such thing as truth, then atheism can't be true. Now, truth is something that fits very well in the Christian worldview. So a lot of problems with atheism. Pantheism is the belief that God is the universe, that God is non-personal, God is an it. It's like Star Wars, the Force be with you. It's not the Lord be with you. And since man is part of the universe, man is God. Lots of problems with pantheism. New Agers are pantheists. Hindus tend to be pantheists. Lots of problems with it. First off, it fails to explain the existence of evil. If pantheism teaches that reality is beyond all duality, so they're really the idea of truth and falsehood, right and wrong, those are really just part of the illusion. So it fails to explain the existence of evil. A pantheist believes in reincarnation. Well, in order for reincarnation to occur, you need physical bodies. You need individual souls that need to be reincarnated in physical bodies. Yet, if pantheism is true, the physical world is an illusion. And individual souls are an illusion because in reality, we're all one being. There are no individual souls. So, if pantheism is true, then you have... then reincarnation is true, but reincarnation needs physical bodies and individual souls. But pantheism teaches that that physical bodies and individual souls are part of the illusion. They don't really exist. So this is contradictory at its core. And if you point out contradictions to a pantheist, they usually act like you're complimenting them. But it's like I told a postmodernist, a class of postmodernists at University of Washington, I was trying to tell him that your view is self-refuting, and one of the guys said, wait a minute, I think I know what you're saying. You're saying that if postmodernism is true, because they deny absolute truth, if postmodernism is true, I cannot communicate consistently with my worldview. I said, well, that's true, but that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, if postmodernism is true, you can't even think consistently with that. Just to think that the lights are on in this room, you're using the law, of course, the law of non-contradiction. You're saying that the statement, the lights are not on in this room, is a false statement. And so you're using the concept there is truth and there is to contradict the truth. You engage in falsehood. And the postmodernist denies that. Well, the pantheist does as well. They also argue that God is unknowable. But how could we know pantheism is true? If God's unknowable, how could we know that God is the universe? And then even the pantheist can't live like the world is an illusion. If I'm walking with a pantheist and you and your buddies start throwing rocks at us, the pantheist will duck as quickly as I duck. Yet I'm being consistent with my worldview. I believe in a physical world. The atheist doesn't. If the pantheist were consistent with their worldview, they would stop eating. Okay? I also don't think there's a whole lot of incentive to be moral if you're a pantheist. Because if somebody really gets on your nerves and you would rather kill them and then kill yourself, you'd just be reincarnated. You might think, well, it might set me back a million years and I'll become a slug. But you might think, you know what, I hate this guy so much it's worth it. Whereas with Christianity, our actions take on eternal consequences. We're not all guaranteed that we're all going to become one with the universe someday. One of the biggest problems with pantheism, when a New Age pantheist or a Hindu pantheist tries to convince you of pantheism, that's one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. Okay? So it's refuting right at the outset. If only one mind exists, why would you have to use your mind to convince my mind that only one mind exists? It's not really consistent. Now, panentheism is kind of the idea that the universe is God's body. Rather than the universe is God, God is the soul of the universe. And they argue that God is both finite, limited, and infinite, unlimited, in his basic nature. Okay? Well, the fact of the matter is that's a contradiction. Something cannot be both infinite and finite in its basic nature. If your nature has limitations, it's a finite nature. If your nature is unlimited, it's an infinite nature. But it can't be both. And so really, panentheism ends up dissolving into a finite God, finite theism. And a finite changing God needs an infinite unchanging God to ground its existence. In other words, the only way the pantheistic God could exist, it couldn't be both infinite and finite. It would only be finite, and then it would need an infinite cause. It would need the God of the Bible to create it. Okay? So it's got some big problems there. By the way, what if somebody tells you, okay, well then Jesus isn't God? Because you're telling me that Jesus is both God and man, so you're telling me that Jesus is both infinite and finite in his basic nature. That's a contradiction. How do we Christians respond to that? Well, it's called the hypostatic union. The Christian theologians came up with this from studying the scriptures, that Jesus is one person with two distinct natures. Natures that don't blend together. He always existed as God, the second person of the Trinity, so he had an infinite divine nature, and without ceasing to be God, at a point in time, he added a human nature. Okay? So Jesus is not both infinite and finite in his basic nature, Jesus is one infinite person who added a finite nature to his divine nature without the two blending. See, if Jesus was half God and half man, he really wouldn't be man and he wouldn't be God. But he's not. He's fully God and fully man. And the only way that could be is if his two natures are distinct. Pantheism, it's one basic nature, both finite and infinite, and that's contradictory. Deism, there's, you know, you get Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, were American deists. The American deists, though, were friends of Christianity. They were pro-Christian deists. They thought that Christianity was good for the common man. Help keep order in society, help promote freedom. They also believe the Bible contained the ultimate in man's wisdom when it comes to government and morality. The French deists, the Jacobins, were anti-Christian deists. They hated the Bible. They wanted to burn Bibles. They wanted to burn churches down and outlaw Christianity. And but whatever the case, the deist believes God created the universe, but then he doesn't intervene. He doesn't perform miracles. But it really doesn't make sense. If God could create the entire universe, why can't he perform lesser miracles than that? If God can create the whole universe out of nothing, then why can't he give sight to the blind? And then they could say, well, maybe he can, but he just chooses not to. Well, if he's going to create man in his image so we can reason, you'd think he'd want to communicate with us. And what better way to get our attention than by performing miracles? Now, the early deists believed that the laws of nature prescribed what can and cannot happen. But now scientists understand that the laws of nature, like gravity, they're descriptive, not prescriptive. They describe the way things generally occur rather than prescribe what can or cannot happen. And if God created the laws of nature, then he can supersede the laws of nature anytime he chooses to do so, to get our attention. By the way, Thomas Aquinas didn't just use miracles as evidence for God. He also used the laws of nature as evidence for God. He argued that when the mindless things of nature move towards the same goals, like acorns becoming oak trees and not apple trees, okay? The mindless things of nature move towards the same goals, then there must be a mind behind nature, governing nature, setting in motion these laws of nature so that things operate the way they're supposed to. Atheists, we'll get into that when we talk about miracles. We'll get more into more depth on that. But basically, the deists, very few deists today, usually if you believe that God exists, you're open to the possibility that he could perform miracles. Finite godism, also called finite theism, that God is limited because of evil. Well, a refutation of that, if a finite limited God exists, then it would need an infinite cause. See, the only way to ground finite limited existence is to posit the existence of some infinite being that grounds the continuing existence of all the finite existence. It gets into one of Aquinas' arguments for God's existence. I believe it was his third way to prove God's existence. We basically said, if everything that exists has the possibility of not existing, then given enough time in the future, every possibility will be actualized. Every possibility will come about. So every possibility for non-existence will be realized and nothing will exist. But if you go far enough back into the past, that same scenario would have obtained way back in the past where nothing would have existed. And since from nothing, nothing comes, something has to exist with no possibility of non-existence to ground the continuing existence of all the beings that have the possibility of not existing. If that goes beyond you, you join the club. It's my favorite argument for God's existence, and I think it's the most powerful argument for God's existence, but I don't even use it when I debate on college campuses because most of the college students just give me a blank stare, and I just realize, okay, that one bombed, and I'll move on. If I do a chart on the board, I can make it a little understandable. But each year when I teach it on the high school level, by the way, things like the hypostatic union, the kenosis, the incarnation, the Trinity, those are things I teach my ninth grade students. And it's a shame that we don't teach. And then so many Christians think, wow, he's teaching advanced theology to ninth graders. No, I'm teaching basic theology to ninth graders, but most American churches today don't even teach basic theology to adults. And so, you know, we need more churches like this one that will invite people. I was asked to come in here. I didn't know this existed. Pastor Mike Forney and Pastor Mario asked me to come in and teach this course. And we need more of that, you know, going on. Pastor's supposed to preach the whole counsel of God, and that's why you need a staff, and you need lay leaders to come in. But whatever the case, everything that is limited, that is finite, ultimately needs an infinite cause. And we'll see that when we argue for God's existence. So a finite God would need an infinite cause. In other words, the only way to save finite theism, you'd have to believe in the God of the Bible creating a finite God. But then the finite God wouldn't be God. It would probably be either an angel or a fallen angel, a demon. A finite God doesn't deserve worship. Worship means that you acknowledge that something is ultimately worthy, is worth more than anything else could possibly be worth. And so only an infinite being would deserve worship. A finite God also cannot guarantee that evil will be defeated. So you might side with a finite God and fight evil, but in the end, evil might lose. And then evil does not prove that God is limited. We'll get into that when we deal with the problem of evil. Then polytheism, the belief in many gods. Some Hindus believe in many gods. Mormons, Latter-day Saints believe in a plurality of gods. Some tribal peoples believe in many gods. But several gods would limit each other. And limited being, now you might say, well, wait, maybe one of them is infinite and the rest are finite. Well, good. Well, then the infinite one is really God and the other ones aren't. Okay? So again, the only way to make sense of this, polytheism, only the infinite God would be the true God, and the lesser gods would be either, you know, angels or demons, but they're not going to be God. So limited beings need an unlimited cause. And so what people think of as the lesser gods, tribal peoples and all, are actually demons. By the way, we got our word demons from an ancient Greek word, daimonios. Okay? And that's where we get our word demon from. But that was one of the words that the ancient Greeks used for the gods. So the ancient Christians and ancient Jews said, what those guys call the gods are actually fallen angels deceiving people. And so we'll borrow that title and use that title of fallen angels, unclean spirits. By the way the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans told stories about the ancient gods, it sounds a lot like, often, many times, it sounds a lot like UFO alien visitations that we get today. And we're finding out that people are saying that these things often appear and disappear at will, that they appear to be non-material, but they can manifest themselves physically. So in those 5% of UFO sightings and alien abduction cases, the 5% that really seem to be legitimate, I agree with, you know, Hugh Ross and the late William Alnor and many others, Walter Martin, late Walter Martin, Norman Geisler, that there is some demonic deception that is going on. And it's not a coincidence that the UFO fanatics are starting to blend with the New Age fanatics and form a UFO / New Age religion. And so basically what we can see is that the core doctrines, the core beliefs of all these other worldviews have problems that just, you know, I mean, that the foundation of these belief systems just kill them. And when the smoke clears, all that's left is theism, the belief in a personal God who is transcendent, exists beyond the universe, but is immanent, involved with the universe, sustains the continuing existence of the universe and can intervene, can communicate to us, can reveal himself to us. This is the only worldview supported by the evidence, and that's what we'll probably talk about for the next either 2 weeks or a week and a half, but the next two sessions or a session and a half, I'll try to present. I'll give you an overview of some of the arguments for God's existence, and then I'll try to share with you my own cumulative case for God that I give on college campuses. So let me look at the time here. And we actually have 7 minutes for questions. So I did really well tonight. I'm proud of myself. When I get home, I'm going to give myself a cookie.
What do you think about the latest thing in the news about Jesus being married?
Jesus being married. Yeah, that's what he was doing. Is there Karen King? This guy, Eric Stenerson, your Master of Arts is in theology or New Testament studies?
Both.
Okay. Yeah, he's the kind of guy, if I'm not around, talk to him. And if you want to add something to this, go right ahead. But I am sick and tired of the Bart Ehrmans, the Karen Kings, the Elaine Pagels. I mean, not only do they slam and act like we can't trust the New Testament documents, which all date back to the first century AD, I would argue that you could make a case that the entire New Testament may have been written before 70 AD. And Jesus was crucified roughly 30 to 33 AD. So the New Testament is written while eyewitnesses were alive. And they said, well, that's not good enough. Okay? There's ancient creeds in there. The ancient creed listing the post, the summary list of the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8. Marcus Borg and Gerd Ludmann of the Jesus Seminar, two guys who denied the resurrection, acknowledged that creed was fully formulated at the latest 1 year after the crucifixion. Yet, the list of all these post-resurrection appearances that Paul passes on to us, something that he received, and Borg and Ludmann say, yeah, Jesus was crucified in 30 AD, that creed was in place by 31 AD, that's not good enough. And then as they're about to walk away, they say, however, we did find some historical evidence that's really good. We found a fragment of a 4th century AD document saying that Jesus had a wife.
No, it doesn't say that.
Yeah. But, yeah, she acknowledges that it might mean he's talking about the church.
It's in Coptic.
And it could be talking about the church, it could be talking about symbolic, but even if you give her the benefit of the doubt, now that there are writings that say Jesus was married, but usually you got to go to the 6th, 7th, century AD. So you've got this huge gap. So what I'm sick and tired about is people like Bart Ehrman and her, they find one little piece of trash 500 years later and they act like this changes everything. And we got 27 books dated to within the lifetime of the Lord Jesus, and that doesn't count for anything. So all I ask of them is use the same standard for the fragments that they find. If they use the same standard, this is so much more trustworthy and close to the fact, much closer to the facts, that they would reject that and accept this. But they don't. They've got a double standard, and so they act like we've got no reason to trust the New Testament documents. And the thing is, you find a fragment of something, how do you even know that fragment even represents what the original said? Well, with the New Testament, we can compare over 26,000 copies in Greek, Latin, Syrian language, and we can figure it out. With these other things, these are untested manuscripts and they're way late. Eric, you have something to add?
Well, I just read about it.
Yeah, she acknowledged that she's not even sure. She can't even be sure that he's actually saying that he had a wife. I think, even if we give her the benefit of the doubt and we say, okay, let's say that the Jesus is there saying he has a wife. This is something written hundreds of years after Jesus walked the earth. And we know that they love, Elaine Pagels loves the Gospel of Judas. She loves the Gospel of Thomas. She loves the Gospel of Peter. But she'll be the first one to admit, yeah, Peter didn't write this, Judas didn't write this, Thomas didn't write this. These are all forged documents written more than 100 years after Jesus walked the earth, which the Gospel of Peter was several hundred years later. And they're forgeries, but they're acting like, but this has as much right to be called original Christianity as the New Testament writers. And I beg to differ. I disagree. And I actually, I'll be honest with you, if you read closely my book, Hijacking the Historical Jesus, and then you read the work of a lot of really good Christian apologists, great defenders of the faith, evangelicals who love the Lord. One of my problems, though, with them is that most of our evangelical scholars give these anti-Christian critics a little bit too much credit. So that I think we need to question, did Mark really write? We have a lot of evangelical pastors that buy into this, that Mark wrote first, and he wasn't an eyewitness, and that Matthew's Gospel and Luke's Gospel borrowed from him, plus from some other sources. I think the early church fathers were right. All the early church fathers who talked about the order of the Gospel said Matthew wrote first. And I actually argue, I think Jesus was crucified in 33 A.D., and I think Matthew's Gospel was written between 35 and 42 A.D. And, I just went over with my students today in class. Paul says, pertaining to believers married to non-believers, I say, but not the Lord. Well, what is he saying? He knows he's recording God's Word. But what he's saying is, Jesus, while on earth, never talked about it. Seems like it's implied that he's got some knowledge of the gospel material, because Jesus addressed marriage between professing believers, but never addressed the issue. What do you do if you get saved and your wife doesn't? And then she wants to leave. She wants to leave, let her leave. If she doesn't want to leave, then you need to stay married to her even though she's a non-believer. And Paul's addressing an issue that Jesus never addressed. How did he know that Jesus didn't talk about it unless he had the same kind of knowledge of the gospel material that we have today? He even talks about it in 2 Corinthians, the brother who's famous for the gospel. He can't mean the preaching of the gospel, because that would identify nobody. All the apostles and early church leaders were famous for preaching the gospel. But he said, if some brother, I don't have to mention his name, you know who I'm talking about, and he's famous for his preaching the gospel, I'm going to send him to you. He's famous for the gospel, and I'm going to send him to you. And as I agree with John Wenham out of Great Britain, that Luke was famous for his gospel as early as the mid-50s A.D. in that region of the world. And but that's one thing that bothers me, is that we've accepted so much wild, bad speculation from liberal New Testament critics, and then we only take what they'll give us, and we still make a strong case for Jesus. Now, that's a good debate tactic. Take what your opponent gives you and still prove your case. But that doesn't mean that evangelical New Testament scholarship should only limit itself to what these infallible posts of the Jesus Seminar will give us. I think there's a lot of strong evidence against their wild speculation.
It seems to be a certain wing.